Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this talk, Jack and I spend time with Eric Fine, portfolio manager and head of VanEck's Emerging Markets Fixed Income Strategy. We first get into Eric's unique background and upbringing. From there, we transition to the world of emerging market fixed income, getting our arms around the landscape and hearing the investment thesis for EM debt in a world of higher inflation and higher rates. The biggest possible takeaway might be Eric's view on developed country debt versus emerging market debt, given the levels of debt around the world today. This is a good discussion for anyone looking to learn more about investing in fixed income in emerging markets. As always, thank you very much for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with VanEck's Eric Fine. Hi, Eric. How are you? Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Justin. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
We wanted to have you on to talk about an area that you specialize in, emerging market and emerging market debt specifically. You run investment strategies for VanEck that focus on this, and you've been doing this for quite a while. So I think it's going to be a good discussion for us because this is an area that, you know, I know very little about. We don't invest in it specifically, but I think, you know, the goal of today's sort of discussion is just to kind of walk through emerging market fixed income, how you think about it, how you invested it in it, and its importance probably in the global fixed income market. So that's going to be sort of the thrust and bulk of our conversation. But to start, great. I wanted to, your background's very, very interesting. So there's two things about your background that I want to start with. One, I just thought if you could kind of tell us how you transitioned from what you were doing before you came to the investment industry and sort of your, I guess the 1.0 version of your professional life and how that transition happened. And then off of that, I want to ask you about three specific things, but I'm going to hold those because I want to hear more about how you got into this.
Sure. Yeah, no, thanks. My professional life started, I started working very, very early. I started working in high school, and I was very active politically and I was very active in politics, and I, started Young Democrats at Langley High School and, Langley and McLean, Virginia. I was born and raised outside the U.S. So I was born, I grew up in France, Switzerland, Thailand. Later in life, we can talk about it if you want, but I have lived in Russia, you know, as a grown up. I became very close to the person who became governor and he ran for Senate. I'd done a lot of jobs in summer. I was into programming, in weapon system design because that's what kids did in McLean, Virginia. If they didn't have other things to do and I just moved from Thailand. I didn't really, the girls were not all over me. And so I was a 14-year-old boy with a lot of time on his hands. And so my early career was national security, but really from a programming weapon system kind of angle. Happened to start at a young age, and then through politics. A funny thing happened. In between college and graduate school, so I continued in those kinds of jobs, and I did get one official job with the government, but that's kind of not really worth talking about. I lost my driver's license. I drove across country. If you get too many speeding tickets in a row, so it wasn't anything, nefarious. And this was when the speed limit was 55 nationally, you lose your license. That was important because the job I was asked to that would have continued my career in politics was involved driving. And it was more, future chief of staff kind of job, but it was for a campaign and for, the gentleman who I helped, elect governor. And so I needed to find other stuff to do. So I always knew I wanted to do emerging markets and, but my first, professionally, my first job working for the U.S. government via Harvard University in Moscow. So I lived there for a few years in the early 90s when the U.S. and more or less owned Russia. It was a very unusual phase in the country. And that gave me a hook, right? Because then, I then worked at Morgan Stanley for 14 years, starting in research. So economics and bond strategy. And the generous way of describing me is that I was the world's leading Russian economist. The accurate way of describing me is I was the world's only Russian economist. And so, the Russia experience gave me a hook because I knew something a lot of that's something that nobody knew about. So it was the nobody knowing about that really helped, not so much, what I knew. And it was a little tricky before I got into that, because EM bonds didn't really exist. But luckily, when I came back from Russia, the bond market had really started. Enough of the loans from the 80s had been securitized into bonds, and it wasn't just Solomon Brothers trading these things. So I had an initial sort of political phase, and, I just didn't really have a lot to do other than play with computers. And so I got into that stuff. I did work formally for the U.S. government briefly and got security clearances, and I had security clearances for, some of the weapon stuff. But yeah, that was it. And you could call the end of that the Russia experience, maybe. But, I designed a clearing system there, so that was kind of finance oriented. But then I got, formally into finance at Morgan Stanley, where I was for 14 years, and now 14 years at VanEck.
Yeah, very interesting, fascinating sort of like worldwide, global sort of probably exposure and perspective. But you do also say in your bio, when we were doing research for this, it's like, ask me about these three things: World War II espionage, growing up the son of diplomats, and you had mentioned, building Russia's first clearing system. So I don't know, just those are really cool things, and maybe just talk about those here.
Sure. Definitely was given a pretty unusual, interesting life. So I was born in France, and my dad was born in Brooklyn, very humble background, and then he was a spy during World War II. So he worked for something called the OSS, which you might have read about, but it was the CIA when we didn't have it. And he had a really interesting job. His job was economic warfare. So he was a PhD economist, but, kind of an interesting guy. And so they landed him in there. He had a team. And the goal was, he was landed in Turkey. Turkey was neutral during World War II. The goal, and it was a huge, it still is. It's country I know a lot about. I trade it. It was neutral. It's a huge agriculture producer. So his two main objectives were, if the price is important to Nazi Germany, make the price high. In other words, go around bidding, have your team bid markets, manipulate markets, literally. And if it's crucial, buy it up and burn it down. Right. And so that's what he did. He did other jobs, but, that was his main thing. Interestingly, after that, he worked for General MacArthur for 8 years during the occupation of Japan. So that was really cool. I grew up with, stories about that. My mom was a diplomat as well. She took the Foreign Service exam, right? And rose, and she was of a generation when there just weren't any women doing that. And so that was really interesting. A neat factoid is, and I was just in Kansas City. She's from Kansas City, Missouri. Very humble background as well. My grandfather had a buddy named Harry Truman. That was his fishing buddy. And when he became senator, he called my granddad and said to Shirley, my mom, who's still alive, she's 96, does she want to work for, I forgot what they called him, the boss, I think is what they called him. But, said yes. They moved to D.C., which is huge back then, right? Leaving, poor town in, Kansas City or around, Missouri. He quickly became vice president and then president. My mom was 5 years in the White House as his secretary. That was kind of interesting. And that's what introduced her, gave her the confidence to take the exam. That's how I grew up. My experience kind of doing that kind of thing was in Russia. I was there in the early 90s. I worked for, technically I worked for Harvard. Larry Summers and Andre Schleifer were the kind of bosses there. I know you've probably heard of Larry, but Andre's also a professor at Harvard. And the U.S. owned Russia, right? And we knew we'd have it for a period of time. And Andre's idea, and I think it was right, was fast is better than good, right? We are not going to have decades to change this thing. We got to privatize this thing and get it in the hands of, individuals other than the state, but individuals. And so the country went with Czech style voucher privatization. They issued 150 million pieces of paper. I've seen these pieces of paper. And every citizen over the age of like 6 months got was able to submit it into an auction system, And you could choose, you could get what you wanted, right? So that you'd be auctioning Gazprom, right? So, okay, I want any share at any price, or I want it only at this price, right? And that required people being able to walk to a place. So we built 33 sites across 13 time zones where people could walk in. You take the thing, it gets shredded, and then you have an electronic entry. So it was really bottom up. You know, interesting, really cool story there is we didn't know how we were going to do what network we were going to use to get stuff across the, you know, in data across the country. And we found the KGB. The KGB had a national fiber optic cable network, which no one knew about, but, you know, because we kind of were, they were, you know, we kind of, I own them as a little too much, too strong a statement, but, you know, we were very friendly. We were kind of doing, you know, what the U.S. does development-wise in these countries. And we found it and it used, and we found that, I found the telecoms infrastructure in the country amazing. It was more just a few bottlenecks here and there, like, you know, switching stations, things like that. But anyway, that's what I did in Russia. And also because there were so many consultants in there and because we were at Harvard, which was kind of the hub of the whole thing, we kind of kept track of things, right? In other words, we told them, look, this is very easy going to these situations. Somebody's, it'll cost $5 million. And it doesn't really, right? And so we were kind of doing, we kind of had a sight on a lot of the things that were going on there. So, but that's what I did.
Fascinating, fascinating background. So does that mean like what has transpired due to the same, well, I guess with Russian nationalizing all these companies, did they effectively undo what you did?
No. It's still a largely private economy. It's an extremely private economy. It's an extremely well-run economy, actually, both at the macro level and at the micro level. The country's got virtually no debt, exchange rates floating. They're up to their necks in reserves. Social metrics are improving. Yeah, so no.
Okay.
If anything, you could argue the economy got a big boost because Chinese companies could buy the auto companies that the Western companies were forced to sell at low prices, right? So you know. But definitely nothing's happened to the economy before, during, or after the war, sanctions-wise or other, that's been serious or worth noting, other than mistaken expectations from sort of Western politics. There was an expectation that sanctions, for example, would destroy. That's, I think it's still the assumption that it's going to destroy the Russian economy. I think that's obviously wrong at this stage. You know, maybe some people thought that was speculative that it would be destroy the Russian economy. But I definitely didn't. But now it's pretty much not debatable. Russia's moved ahead in many ways. Remember in 1998, the Wall Street Journal ran up, maybe it was a little later. No, sorry, it was around 2000, 2001. I think it was a full left column ed. From the editors, praising Putin's economic policy, right? He went with a flat tax. I think they still have elements of it. They've gone with e-government. They've limited debt. So economics is not the issue where I think there are big differences between Russia and orthodoxy or what people sort of expect as kind of high level quality policy. And that's still the case. That's, if anything, it's integrating more with the world now that China and Russia are more partners in progress, more as opposed to sort of erstwhile allies.
As we step into the emerging market, debt market, I just wanted to ask if you could give us an overall overview of the landscape. Like how big is it? Who are the big issuers in terms of countries? Just any other facts do you think would be interesting as we start the discussion on it?
Yeah, no, thanks, Jack. Yeah, so overall, the market is $5 trillion. $5 trillion. So give you a sense, treasuries are around $45 trillion, right? So just to give you a sense. Or to give you another sense, the U.S. corporate bond market is $10 trillion. Right, just a level set. Now, there are different ways of measuring these things, but just big picture, that would be the answer. Now, of that $5 trillion in EM debt, roughly half the U.S. corporate market, so it's a huge market, $3 trillion is debt, $3 trillion worth is debt in EM's own currencies. So a bond issued in Brazilian real or Polish zloty or Thai baht. $1 trillion is government bonds issued or sovereign bonds issued in dollars, right? That's the oldest one, the MBB, you might have heard of, or Brady bonds, right? And then the other trillion is corporate bonds in dollars. So just like the investment grade or high yield market in the U.S. So So that's the size of the market and how it breaks down overall. One thing to know about the dollar bonds are fairly straightforward. They're a lot like high grade, high yield. If yields go up, you lose money. If they go down, you make money on the price, and then you get your carry, which is usually pretty high. With local currency bonds, the $3 trillion of the $5 trillion, rates go up, you lose. Rates come down, you make. But you get your carry, but you have the additional currency risk. The currency can help you or hurt you. So that's the market. The big countries are Mexico, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Poland, Czech, Hungary, Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, Saudi Gulf. Those would be the big names, but there are a lot of smaller names, of course.
So it actually does look a little bit, I was thinking about relative to like the emerging market equity market, but it's actually very, very different, because in the emerging market equity market, China is a huge portion of it. And then you've kind of got everybody else. So this does look a lot different than that.
Yes, I'm glad you observed that. And it's true for Asia. In general, EM equities is about Asia and China, and EM debt is about not that, right? Now there is Asia, and there are Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia are big, but and also EM debt tends to be have a lot more commodity exporters, right? So it tends not to be as hurt by, or many of them benefit from, higher commodity prices.
From the perspective of a U.S. investor, what would be the biggest benefits they might look at when thinking about emerging market debt, of investing in it?
Yeah, so I think it's really straightforward and really topical. That's what I really like about EM for U.S. investors, or any investor really right now. Number one is it's low debt in a world filled with developed markets with high debt levels. And low debt is not a theoretical argument. In other words, when I ran research at Morgan Stanley, sometimes you'd have a piece in which case you'd say, here are the seven things that are going to happen. And then at the end of 2 years, the trade is going to work and, you got to wait. Low debt is an incredibly practical a positive, right? Thailand is issuing less debt than it's paying in principal and interest, right? There are bond shortages, right? The dollar sovereign index pays in principal and interest about the same as it's borrowing. We're so accustomed to the DM, to bond markets endlessly increasing with governments, if you really do a debt sustainability analysis, increasingly not able to pay them. But low debt is number one, right? So you're going to low debt countries in a world where that's a reasonable concern, especially in the DM. Number two, they pay you more. They just pay you more, right? Whether it's with the same rating, you get a slightly higher spread, and it's higher to get that rating, right? The rating agencies are tougher on EM companies and countries. When I say pay you more, if you have debt that is too high, how can a central bank credibly increase interest rates to the extent that it must? That's the situation in EM versus DM. The DMs are facing problems because their central banks, it's called fiscal dominance. Larry Summers has been writing about this recently, but there's a level of debt at which the central bank hiking is only going to bankrupt the government, right? And the DMs are getting into that world, and the EMs are not, because they have low debt. And that allows you to, number two, pay you more. And number three, I think the third benefit of emerging market bonds is it benefits from this new world order that we're reading about, and well, most Americans are reading about for the first time in the newspapers the last few months. And that's especially important because most of the things that U.S. investors in particular can choose in their, or have on their investment menu, don't benefit from that, right? So, in particular, I think the facts of the new world setup, let's call it that, are commodity supply risk, right? Iran and Saudi recognizing each other, and Saudi Arabia and Russia cooperating, is a fundamental change in supply dynamics for oil, right? And Saudi's already cut two times unexpectedly in OPEC since this, sort of new setup. And so those are the some obvious things. A fun fact on supply risk, 40% of the world's uranium comes from one country, Kazakhstan, right? And if they want to turn that off, they can turn it off. So supply risk is one obvious fact that, even if you rely on newspapers, right, for your, financial news, you could kind of see that. The other big one, though, and this is going to be a long process, but it's a huge tailwind for a lot of EM local currencies. I don't happen to like local right this second, but it's going to be a huge 10-year tailwind, and very few things that investors can invest in benefit from that, and that is the use of each other's currencies as reserve currencies. When Saudi Arabia agrees with China to receive CNY for oil, what do you think the Saudi Central Bank is going to do with that CNY? Well, I'll tell you what they're going to do. They're going to do what they did with dollars. The dollar has been the pricing currency, the pricing currency for you know, most commodities and energy. They've been receiving dollars. What do? They buy treasuries, right? They're up to their necks in treasuries. They're lending us money, right? What do you think they're going to do with the CNY? They're going to buy CNY bonds, right? Now, I'm not saying they're picking up the phone right now buying the whole Indonesian bond market, right? But that is a huge phenomenon. And it means that the market, I certainly pay a lot less attention to flows in and out of our market now, because the central banks are buying these bonds and they're reducing their exposure to treasuries. So I think those are the three big reasons are low debt in a world rightly concerned about high debt, and paying you more in a world rightly concerned about, well, are they paying us enough? And then third, most importantly, maybe it benefits from these developments that we see, which to most Americans, I think are, wow, that sounds bad, which they may or may be, but that's not my job. My job's to, you know, find opportunities. And there are a lot in EM bonds.
For investors who are used to investing in debt in the U.S. and in developed markets, what are some of the unique concerns that are different for emerging market bonds versus investing in those markets?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm going to say something pretty funny, and it's going to surprise, well, maybe not funny, but funny, surprising. I think the risks are not where you think they are, right? What has been the story of the last 6 months? The story of the last 6 months have been developed markets blowing up the world, starting with Japan exiting from its monetary experiments of higher yields and weaker FX, otherwise known as no place to hide, right? Higher rates and weaker FX means everything is bad, right? Who was next? The UK, right? The UK submit, they're also subject to fiscal dominance. They submitted a budget, was rejected. The financial system transmitted it because, you know, whatever, it's somewhat complicated. The pension funds suffered losses. And the financial system is always a liability of the government. But in any case, they have too much debt. They submitted a disappointing budget, and it was rejected by the market and gilts, bills. In our, you know, we can look back in time, within the last 6 months, printed a 15% bill, 1.5, right? And the prime minister lost her job in 90 days. So tell me who the emerging market is, right? And then you have the U.S. Then you have the U.S. rising. You have default risk. Right, you had like the June 6 bill, whatever it was, trading, you know, a couple hundred basis points different than the neighbor bills. You had default political risk, right, affecting asset prices. So the most important message I would say is don't trust. I would have a lot less comfort with the things you think are totally safe and comfortable with, and I'd be a lot more willing to listen to the EM story. The EM story, by the way, you know, for the last 20 years, has done better than developed market bonds. It's just that you lost me at bonds, right? In other words, yeah, well, I don't even want to talk about bonds. And now we're talking about bonds, so of course we're talking treasuries and high yield. And so I'm just going to buy that, right? And they don't want to, but yeah, the last 19 years, to be precise, EM has had some of the best categories. And now yields are high nominally, so I think that outperformance versus the developed markets is going to happen. So my main point would be, the main thing to remember, or the main thing to consider, is no one has it, and you probably have too little, and you probably have too much of other stuff. That would be my main message.
Before we step into your investment strategy, I just wanted to ask you about currency hedging, because you mentioned currencies before. It seems like currency would be a very complicated issue, you know, in emerging markets. You've got some issuing their own currency, you've got some issuing other currencies. Like, the issue of hedging currency, I think, would be a big part of your job, but correct me if I'm wrong on that. Like, how do you think about currency?
Yeah, so we almost never hedge currency because it's too expensive. Now, so we invest in bonds with high real interest rates, and so if we, for example, were to hedge the currency risk in Brazil, we would pay out all of that interest rate to hedge that risk. So we want countries with high real interest rates, and you know, that's our investment process. Hedge, and that's fairly typical of funds like yours. It's we believe in general in covered interest parity. I don't know if you remember that. I don't know if there's a Nobel Prize for it yet, but Ken Rogoff innovated it. But essentially, you know, you shouldn't be able to arb, let's say, a 1 year FX forward and a 1 year bond in the currency. And so we like the bond. And so only if there are weird things going on in the market would we say that one is better than the other. I think that's one of the big mistakes a lot of funds make, is that they separate out the FX from the interest rate. And that is just conceptually wrong, because there's inflation in the FX and inflation in the interest rate. Inflation can be defeated by a stronger FX or higher rates, but they're both the same thing. And so, we do not hedge. If we don't like it, we don't own it.
So stepping into your process, step one of your process is music to our ears, because we're quantitative investment managers. And I think you sort of have a value screen you start with that I think is primarily quantitative. So can you talk about that step?
Yeah, it's, we designed and built it ourselves. It's in our servers right now. My team has huge ownership of it. I've been building it over decades, but we take country fundamentals. There are precisely 15 variables, econometric variables, or economic variables, sorry. We compare every country to all the other countries, right? So there are 15 variables. There are some solvency measures like your debt to GDP. There are some flow measures like your fiscal balance or your current account deficit. And there are some structural measures like common equity to assets in your banking system, right? So we have 15 variables, and we look at every country on each one of those variables, right? And then we turn that country into a Z-score, so we know how different that country is from all the other countries. Now, we do not equally weight the fundamentals. What we do is we do a series of cross-section regressions to optimize the weights so that we get a best fit, right? So we get a best fit for the weights. But once we've established the Z-score, again, a Z because we want to know how different the countries are, we line up all the countries who have dollar bonds, like dollar non-government bonds, and we say, okay, what are your yields? And if the yield is too high relative to the predicted level, our process likes it. If it's paying too much, if it's paying more in yield or spread, right? Same thing, basically. If you design it right, the more it pays, the more we're going to like it. If it's paying more than any other country with that, with those fundamentals, we're going to like it. One important footnote is, because there's tenors in bonds, right? There's duration in bonds. And we do this for every tenor. So what I just described of the fundamentals and the weighting and lining up the countries and comparing it to the yields, we do it for twos, fives, sevens, tens, 30s. So if the 30s deviates more from the predicted level, it gets the vote. We're not saying, oh yeah, we're the world's greatest treasury traders and we're going to trade EM based on our treasury view. We just do it bond by bond. But that's the core of our process, 100% quantitative. And been running it for 14 years officially as a fund, but I was using it long before that.
And then, do you have a qualitative step on top of that? Once the quantitative step is spit out what it likes, then you make decisions with your portfolio team as to what to do beyond that.
Yes, spoken like a true commonsensical quant. Yes, the world doesn't always work that way. There's non-systematic risk, and you got to catch them. And what we strive to do is document. We try to be precise as possible for something that's subjective, and we tend to document it. Often there's a lot of quantitative information that goes into it, but a human being needs to look at it. There are three tests. We give two passing grades and two failing grades. And if you get a strong fail, you're kicked out. The main point is to communicate and be clear. We document, we take a picture of, we have spreadsheets and things, and we take a picture of what we've done and write a little thing. But every month we'll say, we reduce this because it failed this test, if the test was the reason for the change.
It's interesting because we have like a standard closing question we're going to go over with you at the end, where we ask everyone who comes on, like, what's the one lesson they teach the average investor? And, one of our good friends, Tobias Carlisle, was on the podcast recently, and his idea was this idea of writing everything down, which I think is what you're getting at here, which is like, how do I know if I made a good decision in the past, if I don't like log when I actually did in a qualitative process and be able to go back and look at it, knowing what I knew at the time?
Yeah, I'm a big fan, I am one, but I think if you grow up in, growing up in research changes you. I'm sure growing up in anything changes you, but it really does. I could not, I was in research for over 10 years before I started the trading desk. I would not have, at least me, I would need I need a rigorous process. I'm not going to wake up in the morning and have a feeling about markets. I need a guide, and it has to be valuation oriented. I did run a trading desk, which was buy low, sell high at the end of the day. I like cheap things, right? And that's the core of the process. We want cheap. We don't want good or bad. We want cheap.
You had mentioned at the beginning that most of emerging market debt is sovereign debt. Corporates are smaller. Is that how your portfolio ends up looking too? Does it end up looking mostly sovereigns with some corporates?
Yeah. Now, the sizes of the corporate market, is about the same as the dollar sovereign market. It's about $1 trillion each. But the biggest difference to me is the illiquidity, or the potential illiquidity, because illiquidity is somewhat of a silly concept. Everyone says liquidity, they'll look at measured liquidity and say, oh, look, it's liquid. That's not what you want. That's not a useful thing to know. What you want to know is in a stressed scenario, and we haven't had stressed scenarios. I've been doing this a few decades, but we haven't really had stressed scenarios where you've seen significant outflows from corporate bonds. So illiquidity would be the bigger concern I would have on the corporate side. And I'm sorry, Jack, I'm forgetting, got into that, and then I forgot.
No, just asking if your portfolio ends up looking like mostly sovereigns and with a smaller position of corporates.
So we're a blend fund. We're the world's first emerging market blend fund, which means that we invest in all of the things that you just talked about, right? Some EM bond funds just invest in one of those three things. We invest in all of them. And the benchmark for blend fund is half local, half hard. And we had a lot of local for most of this year, and we've reduced it significantly. So we're at about, maybe 50%, a little less than 50% in EM local currencies right now. Most of it's in dollars. And we have about 10% in corporates. I'm a bit worried right now. It's hard for us to find value in corporates right now. And I would be worried about, I'm always worried about illiquidity risk there. So I really need a good case. I'm more comfortable buying corporates that are beaten up than I am that are just sitting there in steady state.
And how do you think about concentration in countries? And if you have a country you particularly like, will you be willing to over-concentrate in it, or do you try to stay pretty diversified across the universe?
Yeah, so great question. First and foremost, our risk limits refer to a risk benchmark. They refer to the benchmark that investors expect us to adhere to. And if we really like something, we can own 1.5 times benchmark weight. And if we really don't like something, we do have to own some of it. However, our limits are pretty smart, and we have been around a long time. And we are able, I think most importantly, to not own things. Right. That's, I think, especially important in bonds, because bonds is about not losing money. Right. And so we are allowed to exclude up to 15% of AUM that's in the benchmark. But we can only do up to 15%. So for example, we're the only EM bond fund in the world that had no Russia. Right. In EM, the benchmark, the benchmarks sometimes have 10% slices. But so it's not, unusual to. And so you really need to be able to completely exclude things. Similarly, on the concentration side, yes, we do. So when we say we can own 1.5 times a benchmark weight of a name, if it's very small, if it's de minimis, let's say it's Ecuador, maybe 20 basis points in the index, we're not subject to such a tight limit there. There we can own up to 2.5%. And we do like doing that, where it's still liquid for our fund, totally liquid, but extremely additive, right? We're not going to, spend time on a 10 basis point thing. So in general, the principle for the fund is we don't want to have, we want to have the cheapest bonds in emerging markets within risk limits that are fairly normal, right? What we've done with them, maybe, our performance, I've heard is excellent, but our limits don't really distinguish us, but we do. I would say what may distinguish us is we use that flexibility. A lot of people call me, years ago on the Russia, I grew up, a lot of my friends are my competitors and they grew up with me as the Russia analyst. And it was a big learning moment for me because it taught me how hard it is for portfolio managers to deviate from the benchmark, even when a problem is staring you in the face. We pulled the trigger. We got out completely before the invasion, long before the invasion. But it did highlight to me how, and indices for bonds are perverse because they reward leverage, right? And the other thing is you're often not getting paid that much for these bonds, right? So if you're taking that kind of existential risk, you know, you better be getting that something for it. That's why we try to not to think of we want good or bad. We just want cheap. We want to get paid for these risks. And in Russia, you definitely weren't getting paid for this. And it's really important to completely avoid those things. Don't satisfy yourself with, oh, I'm an underweight. That's not a satisfactory answer in bonds.
Yeah, to your point on exclusions, like that's probably one of the biggest lessons in my career is I've always wanted to invest in the best things. But the other side of it's really important, too. Like the stuff you're not investing in is also just as important as the stuff you are investing in. And that's something I've learned the kind of the hard way over time.
Yeah. No, that's totally right. And I almost always have to volunteer it when I'm meeting with investors, you know, regardless. I always say, well, probably the most important thing is we don't own these three big things that everyone else owns, which, you know, I can tell you what they are right now, but if you want to know. But there are some big names that everyone owns. And the market is just so, you know, it's still, people are reluctant to deviate too much from the benchmark because it in their minds, I think, gives investors uncertainty. I think you're supposed to avoid being too much like the benchmark. There are plenty of cheap ETFs that can recreate a benchmark, and you know we have those too, great ones. I think there's an AUM there. You know, AUM does make you think a little differently.
You mentioned duration a little bit earlier. I'm just curious, how do you think about that? Like, how do you think about setting the duration of your portfolio? How does it change over time? Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Number one, we think of duration bond by bond. So when we say, you know, I've given an example of like a country like Russia, where more or less every single thing got kicked out, right? We just, you know, we rejected the whole thing. But it's bond by bond. So we may even think that policy and politics risk affects a 30-year bond, but doesn't affect a 2-year bond, right? So every single bond. So when we say we come up with a list of the cheapest bonds, so we'll come up with a list of the cheapest 2-year bonds. We run those three tests on each one of them, right? So and the three tests are policy, politics, kind of straightforward. But let's say you get a hawkish central bank, right? That may be very supportive of front end rates. Maybe it affects duration. Maybe it doesn't, right? But you have to have a curve. It's not as simple as saying, oh, it's good for the local bond market, right? It's got to be bond by bond, tenor by tenor. So that's number one. Number two, there are often scenarios where you need to be wary of being a treasury trader, right? In other words, we don't think we're the world's leading treasury traders. We don't want to trade EM based on our view on treasuries. And so there are some tests which we would include in one of our three tests, which is the technical test. And it would be a simple spread divided by yield. Across duration. It sounds simple and old-fashioned, but it's like, it's kind of my version of, are you doing what your job is, or are you doing something else, right? Is the spread a high percentage of the yield? The lower it gets, the more you're not doing your job, right? And so the more you need to be really sure about a treasury view. So that's the second part. And then the last is, we do use our duration. We can be plus or minus 3 versus the benchmark. We like duration right now. It's almost only in dollar-denominated bonds, a very diverse selection of them. We've been increasing duration. We're probably going to continue to increase it. We like duration right now as a general principle, but it is a view derived the way I mentioned. In other words, bond by bond by bond. If you ask me what I thought about treasuries, I would say, yeah, 30-year looks like it's trading pretty well versus the 10-year, and it looks like a range. And I would also say that... I think they're kind of two simple scenarios for the Fed. Either they hike and duration rallies, or they don't and duration rallies. I don't think, you know, I hate to make it. And the last thing I'd say is very few treasury traders have, you know, really love the talking about the 30-year. I don't know, at least my friends who trade they hate talking about it. And that makes me excited about it. It makes me more comfortable having a view on it. But the main answer is the ones I mentioned at the beginning, bond by bond by bond. But yeah, there's some cases where we have to, you know, either accept a position that's got that risk or reject one. And we do that sometimes. And that would be in step two through the tests.
So most of your duration is in dollar-denominated bonds, right?
Yes. A lot of the EM curves are pricing cuts already. So, you know, they're kind of inverted and they're ending up being carry trades. And, you know, carry trade is one step away from being the FX is weakening because, you know, nobody likes chocolate anymore and they all want strawberry. And so, the carry, what is it called? Carry junkies, right? That just flips. And so, So yeah, and also I think the big concern we have in local currency is China. CNH is weakening, right? A stimulus, the easiest stimulus and the most jobs intensive stimulus is one that stimulates the export sector. That's a weaker currency. And who cares that the currency is weaker? It's not passing through to inflation. They don't have an inflation problem. Maybe from a stability standpoint, a stability image, but that's a rate, not a level problem, right? That's just slow it down kind of issue. CNY has weakened dramatically against Chile peso, kind of, you know, the Dr. Copper of EM, against Mex peso, even against, somewhat against South African Rand. But it has, a lot of high-risk countries have outperformed a real risk driver, CNH, and that's a really risky moment. So we're very cautious on local. We have no South Africa, no Mexico local. We do like Brazil a lot. We like Brazil a lot. What's not to like about a 13% policy rate and 4% inflation? Right. I mean, you know, those guys are as orthodox as it comes, right? They're a net creditor in dollars. They have more dollar reserves than dollar debt. They could buy it all back. So, you know, Brazil's idiosyncratic, right? It was way early on hikes, and that's exactly what you want in this kind of world, right? That's kind of another way of looking at it. But yeah, anyway, that's what I'd say.
You just mentioned a few of them, but are there any other areas you really like or really dislike, right?
We're pretty diversified, right? So there's really no table pounder other than Brazil, but you know, a lot of people like Brazil. That's one of my worries is where, you know, I would say a place worth highlighting, because we own it but I think it'll be a bigger play a bigger role in the future is sub-Saharan Africa. Now that Europe can't buy energy and a lot of other commodities from Europe, Africa is the place and it's happening. And so there are countries like Mozambique, where Total and Eni, which is going to be a big part of the gas answer to Europe, or even a Zambia or Angola that have elected outsiders from non-legacy parties running on anti-corruption agendas, who have IMF programs. You're getting 500 over in some of those cases, 500 over treasuries, or 900 over in the case of Mozambique. Like I said, a lot of them have IMF programs, so they are funded. And some of them are secularly improving. So that's worth noting because it's new and most investors don't have exposure to that kind of stuff. Note that, there are countries like Colombia and Mexico that can suffer if the world goes into a recession, but that's going to be reflected in the risk to currency weakness. The chance that they're going to default on their dollar bonds is almost zero, right? In other words, you can have problems, but default is, you don't need to jump to default as a possible conclusion. And so duration there looks very attractive in dollars, right? In other words, that should rally along with treasuries. The local currency doesn't necessarily because, you know, treasuries may be rallying because of weak final demand, because of a bad risk story. And I think too many people in global risk markets think that the turn in rates is the turn in risk. And the turn in rates is not the turn in risk. The turn in rates is the turn in rates only, right? Everybody wants to jump out and buy NASDAQ just because the 10-year rallied. That's the complete wrong attitude at this stage in the market, I think. And how I would extrapolate from what I'm seeing in markets to broader markets is there's some good duration, but EMFX looks like it's got some headwinds.
Coming out of the fixed income world just for a minute, this headline kind of caught my attention. I'm interested in what you think. I guess Goldman Sachs put out a report today estimating that by 2035, so EM stock market value. So we're coming out of fixed income now, but EM stock market values will be equivalent to US stock market values, sort of showcasing or highlighting like that eventually what they're saying is, you know, EM stocks will be worth, like they're saying out in 2075. So this is quite a number of years out, but that, you know, EM stocks will be about 55% of the overall global equity market value and the US will be 22%. So I just find that interesting, highlighting like the growth. And that's in equities, of course. I know we're talking fixed income, but I don't know. I just found that interesting.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think One way it could happen is that the developed markets have problems over the next 10 years, which is kind of my central case if I had to have one. We don't really think that far. I mean, we think that far ahead, but we don't invest that far ahead, right? You know, our flashlights, kind of more or less, it depends on the environment. Right now, maybe 3 to 12 months, 6 to 12 months. So part of it could come from you know, the West having issues, particularly higher rates. To me, the most interesting thing would be the amount of leverage in the developed markets it took to get here, right? At the central bank level, there's just an incredible amount of leverage. And at the banking system level, there's leverage. Common equity to assets in emerging markets is like 2 standard deviations superior to developed markets. So there's a lot of leverage puffing up those markets. So number one, I agree, but the dynamic might be shrinkage in the other. But overall, look, I'm a policy guy. I'm an economist. I like countries. I'm not excited by growth. Right. I get worried when there's too much growth. So if things are growing too fast, you know, I have a complete different, I'm on the other side of equities in a way. Right. So, but yeah, no, fundamentally, these are countries that are all re-rating. And that thesis sounds like a re-rating thesis, and I think it makes complete sense. EM is re-rating, and these countries are going to become reserve currencies, right? And Larry Summers has said this for decades, right? The central bank should own a basket of emerging market currencies as their reserve currencies. And this has always been kind of the plan. And now there are a lot of good countries that have, for decades now, maintained good policy, defined as, you know, maintaining high real interest rates. I mean, look at the world. What do you have? 6% inflation in Australia. What are you? 8 to 10 in the UK. 4 in Brazil, right? EM and in Asia, right? You disinflation had deflation. China maybe is at risk of deflation, but even Thailand, Malaysia, Philippines, you know, inflation is just not a story, and it's possibly a story here.
Justin's question has got me curious about this, because one of the things we see, you know, we kind of operate in the equity space, and, you know, a lot of the guys that use long-term data to evaluate emerging market equities are saying, you know, you're like in a once-in-a-lifetime top opportunity right now in terms of valuations. Like, equities are like in a 1% type situation in terms of where they usually are. And I'm just wondering, does that translate to debt as well? Like, are you also seeing like really extreme opportunity in emerging market debt relative to what it would normally look like?
Well, first, it's very hard for me to get into equities because it's just not my world. I don't know valuations. I didn't grow up in that world. I would say that I get why the argument's being made, because there's been a secular decline in inflation, which means interest rates and, in general, all financial asset prices should be a lot less volatile. Now, that's a long process, but the market treats volatility as risk, right? You know, because we don't know how to any better definition of risk ex post. So it will reward that over time. I would say the next 10 years, the bigger dynamic is going to be seeing how the money experiments in the US and Japan and Europe unwind. I think that's probably going to be the bigger dynamic. I think it's going to be so much money has been created. Balance sheets have gotten so much bigger, and they got bigger in let's say in the U.S., much bigger than what they officially said, right? You know, I think they said it got to $4 trillion, but it probably got to around $20 trillion, right? You know, a lot of checks were written to the global banks. I think they've added it up to like $15 trillion. But in any case, the balance sheet expanded a lot, massively, in ways that are not measured. I've written about this. This is not my theory. This is fact, but it's slightly. Off track. And so when you have all this money printed and you have an area that didn't do it, bad money seeks good. And so I think the dynamic is going to be money exiting the DMs that actually have big current account deficits and fiscal deficits, money exiting them and repricing the EMs, whether it happens through their currencies or their equities. I don't know. But I think that's going to be the dynamic. You know, I think it's important for people to ask what happens if the dollar loses its status as the global reserve currency. And there are ways of measuring that that are pretty quantitative and technical that nobody uses. I don't know why. I've written it up every once in a while. But it's a good way of measuring the true leverage in the developed market. So what I did was I said, so the assumption is treasuries lost their status. Okay, so now I'm looking at the balance sheet and all you got is gold as an asset, right? Because our assumption is treasuries are not anymore. And so I did this for every central bank in the world. I said, okay, what's your gold? What's your gold? What's your gold? What's your gold? And I divided it by, of course, the left side, which is money. Which money? You choose, right? I did M0, I did M1, M2, right? But you get insanely high number from a country like Japan. It's like $200,000 an ounce. You know what Russia is? 3,000. They could do a currency board right now with gold almost, right? A lot of the EMs have a lot of gold relative to the amount of money. And a lot of the DMs have a ton of money relative to the amount of gold. Now, you ask long-term, that's why I'm giving you a long-term answer. So I'm not saying, I would not trade on the basis of this. But over the next 10 years, that is a good anchor. Bad money is going to seek good money. And yes, it may be show up as equities doing well, but it's going to be a very deeper dynamic, I think, that drives it. And it's also going to be about finding the countries that are going to attract the good money. Because the big problem is, what do you do as a U.S. investor about China? Right? It seems to me the same, you know, I've traded North Korea, Iraq, all these kinds. I've been dealing with the sanctions office for over 30 years in the U.S. It's not alien. And the one rule from sanctions is they never stop. Right? So if the discussion has started, it is only going to escalate and get worse. When it happens, I don't know. But if there are a lot of termites in a chair, I'm not sitting in it and waiting. I'm just finding another chair, right? I'm not going to. I think that's a real problem for the EM equity story is the size of China and the fact that a lot of people want no China mandates. And I understand why.
I think when a lot of people think about emerging markets, you know, they're thinking about some of these countries in Africa or other places around the world where there's like maybe political instability or there's some other like headline risk that it looks like. But what I think, and I sort of agree with you on, is eventually it seems like there's a tipping point in the developed world where it seems to me like investors are going to wake up maybe one day and just be like, this is not sustainable anymore. And that's going to be sort of like, it's almost like maybe the instability in those countries will be accepted. You're getting compensated to some extent for some of that instability. Of course, they're not all unstable. I'm just saying, I think that is to some extent on, you know, in investors' minds when they're thinking about emerging markets. And then just to build on that, and I'm really interested in this. We have a friend who launched a ETF that invests in equities again, but she overweights those countries that have the highest degree of freedom. So she has this freedom index. So it's like emerging market countries that have that. And she has like a scale and weights like freedom and however she does that. But is that at all like this, not ESG, but do you guys look at what countries are doing politically from a stability standpoint and like kind of bring all that into your model?
Yeah, totally. So first on your first question, yeah, I might, you mentioned, you know, African countries or countries that are considered, you know, high risk. And I would say two things. First, you're getting paid for the risk. And second, I would say it's just not true anymore. Right. I mean, who do you think is going to last longer? President Putin, President Xi, President Erdogan, President Modi, or President Biden? Who do you think is going to last longer? I mean, I'm not saying it to be, you know, one say or another. And think I didn't grow up here, right? And, you know, you got to think of how things look from the outside, and things don't look good from the outside. I don't think any American could deny that. It doesn't matter which side you like or whatever you think. There's no way it looks good to the outside. And those things are hard to price, but also end up being hard to ignore, right? So I view it as political risk was never a thing here, and it's priced that way, and it shouldn't be. And political risk is always a thing in my countries. And all they've done for the last 30 years is not have any crisis and get inflation lower. Fine, there's always going to be some emerging market you can point to. Oh my gosh, this country, that, you know, and that tends to drive the story. And I love those things because we're usually buying, right? Because, mm-hmm. You know, something's being exaggerated. On your second question, the best measure of non-political factors, because I don't really trust any political measures, right? They all say everything about the person doing it and nothing about reality. I've never really seen It's that I just don't like those things because they say everything about the designer and nothing about reality. But yeah, the problem with freedom indices and measures of political freedom is that they, I mean, at least in my read, they say everything about the writer and nothing about the reality, right? And I've lived in, you know, so that'd be my main thing. I would say something extremely useful is something like the Ease of Doing Business survey, which is a multi-decade survey done by the World Bank in which they send, and it's one of the most rigorous microeconomic surveys in the world. They go to these countries and they literally measure how long it takes to open an ice cream shop. How many permits do you need to get? What is the cost? What is the, is how many, you know, you have to go, how many fire safety inspections do you have to go? Those sorts of things. And you know what happened to it? So this amazing study that answers your exact question in a politics-free way, well, turns out that this study was being manipulated, right? And it turns out that the head of the World Bank at the time, that there was Chinese influence in changing how it was made. And there was an investigation into it. It was considered wrong. The White House, the U.S. White House, actually reviewed the head of the World Bank because she had been made head of the IMF, and they gave her a pass. So tell me again who the emerging market is. Again, it's one of these things, right? So I'll give you another story. In the global financial crisis, right? All of my countries, after they had a crisis, the IMF went to them and said, hey, you know what? You got to clean up these public-private banks, these financial institutions, right? And the IMF did the same to the U.S. It said, hey, you know what? This Fannie Freddie thing is just not sustainable. What is it, right? And the U.S. is the biggest shareholder in the IMF. The rules ended up changing, right? You had to own a bigger amount. The rules just changed. Oh, no, you have to own a bigger percentage of Fannie and Freddie to count it on as your government debt. And at the time, it would have added over 50% of GDP to U.S. debt, right? So even our numbers and frames of references are very distorted, I think. And I think that's... So again, I'm turning your answer on the head. There are great ones. Ease of Doing Business survey is great. It was destroyed in a great, sad, you know, almost, you know, I don't want to call it corrupt, but that's... Newt Press was written in that vein, and the person responsible was vetted, or was re-vetted, because that scandal kind of arose, and it just kind of passed, gave her a pass. So again, another example of EMs don't do that kind of thing, right? EMs, EMs, you're never going to convince a voter in many of my countries to harness a central bank to achieve growth objectives. You're just not going to get it, right? I don't, the most far left or far right, I don't care what kind of voter in any, you know, you're just not going to get it because they've been through it, and it destroys the financial system, right? It destroys the poor, it destroys society. You always end up with inflation. You're just not, they're not open to those sorts of things. And we haven't experienced that, right? And so we're more open to them policy wise. And I think that's a big part of the setup. The world can be explained through the lens of fiscal dominance, and fiscal dominance characterizes the DM and doesn't characterize the EM. And because they're both happening at the same time, EM becomes a safe haven. And that's what happened this year. That's what's incredible. You had a banking crisis in the United States, and almost every single EM local currency rallied. It's up like 7%, you know, as an index around that this year. A banking crisis in the U.S., and EM rallied. That's pretty incredible.
So a little bit of a hard pivot here at the end, but we do want to ask you, so we have a standard closing question, and you can go anywhere you want with it. It can be related to EM debt. It can be related to anything that you believe in here. But based on your experience in the markets, if you could teach one lesson to your average investor, what would that be?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll, you know, nobody was thinking about U.S. defaulting, you know, let's say 12 months ago. And then all of a sudden they were a couple months ago. Nobody thought the U.K. would print a 15% coupon on gilts. And, you know, then they did, or the prime minister would last 90 days. And so my main point would be just to paraphrase, because I probably won't get the quote perfect. Mark Twain, it ain't what you don't know that's going to get you, right? It's not something... Right, that you don't understand, that it's what you know for sure that ain't so. Right, it's the thing you're totally sure of that you're never worried about that's not right. That's would be my main message. And so when debt levels matter, And the U.S. is getting, U.S., Europe, Japan are getting to stages where you're getting into the more timing calculations, like interest expense as a percentage of total. You know, Larry Summers has a great quote. He's like, once you're measuring a budget on a month-to-month basis, it's game over. I think that's almost a direct quote, right? So you're getting to that kind of point. So now, or you, now you're kind of, you know, in the musical chairs stage or the termite stage where you can kind of see the termites and you kind of, people are beginning to know they shouldn't really sit on that chair. So I would say it's what you're totally sure of that's dangerous. That's the main message. And the things that you think of as dangerous are at least paying you, and they sure weren't dangerous for the last 20 years.
Thank you very much for all your time today, Eric. If people want to learn more about the fund, follow maybe some of your research, where can they go to learn more?
So our website is www.vanek.com. And my name's Eric Fine, F-I-N-E. I'm on LinkedIn. And you can email me even.
Great. Thank you, Eric. Have a good summer.
All right. Thanks, Justin. Thanks, Chuck. Thanks, Chuck. You as well.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarbonell. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carbonell and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.